Good morning. Welcome to our Sunday service for January 28th, 2018. A very rainy Sunday, but glad you're all here today. In the spirit of gratitude and respect, we want to acknowledge the Saanich First Nations on whose traditional land we gather today. My name is Larry Bolt, and I have the privilege to serve as your worship associate today at First Unitarian. Our seventh principle states, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. In keeping with this principle, you will notice today a slight change. When you arrived, there was no order of service. We wanted to see how a service would work where we used less paper. And if I could invite Reverend Shauna up for an announcement, please.
Good morning. It's lovely to see all of you again, just back from being with colleagues in Florida. We returned on Friday evening and got a text message last night from Lorna Anthony letting us know some sad news that I want to share with you this morning, which is that on Wednesday evening, the 24th, while we were away, Murdy Chilton passed away. Murdy had been in decline for some time. I just went to visit her on the 12th, so I just saw her within the last couple of weeks and found her to be, while in decline, still the Murdy that I had come to know and love in our 7.5 years here with you. Those of you who knew Murdy, her picture is there, will know that she had an amazing sense of humor. She said to me on the 12th that it's part of what got her through her 90-plus years of life, that sense of humor, that stick-to-itiveness. And probably this morning one of you is sitting on a chair that has a plaque on the back of it that Murdy herself donated. I told her when I saw her on the 12th that I had been recently sitting beside a chair that she had donated to the congregation. And I thanked her for her one and only being. I thanked her for her light, for her life, for all that she had shared with this community over the years when I saw her. And so I want to invite us now into a time of silence, those of you who knew and loved her, and those of you who didn't know her at all, but know that all of us stand on the shoulders of those people who have prepared a way, who have opened a door, who have helped a community to flourish. So let's take a moment of silence now for Murdy Chilton. Murdy, we thank you. Murdy, we love you. And Murdy, we will not forget you. Blessed be.
Good morning. Our opening words today come from the poet Margaret Kipe, but before we hear them, I'd like to invite Helen Bosdansky forward to light our chalice. I was going to introduce Helen with all of the things that she's done here over the years and realized that the list was longer than the sermon. And so, are you okay down there?
Yeah.
Fantastic. It is a great joy today. We are hearing a service and sermon that was inspired by a conversation that Helen and I had and by her purchase of my sermon at the auction. So, Helen, thank you so much. The words of Margaret Kipe. Surely, as we belong to the universe, we belong to one another. We join here to transcend the isolated self, to reconnect, to know ourselves to be at home, here on earth, under the stars, touched by one another. May this light light our way. I'd like to invite forward any kids or the young at heart who are still back in their seats and want to come forward. Our story this morning is it's an old family story. I don't know how many of you know, but I'm a wolf. I am. But I want to tell you the story of a distant family member. We're talking like 8 cousins, 17 times removed. Some of you might know him as the Big Bad Wolf. I'm here to tell you today about the true story of the wolf. So it's important to know that sometimes, you know, we only hear stories from one side or the other. Most of us only know this story from one side. So, this is my cousin, Alexander Wolfe. And Alexander got this reputation of being the big bad wolf, all because of a day in which he had a cold and he needed a cup of sugar. So, we think about wolves, and sometimes we think about wolves as being big and bad because they eat cute things. They eat bunnies and, you know, they eat chicks and they eat the cute little animals. You know, if cheeseburgers were cute, we'd probably think you were big and bad too. So this day started because Alexander wanted to make a cake for his grandma. That's a nice thing to do. But Alexander was missing a cup of sugar. He ran out. So Alexander, with his cold, took his empty cup and went to the neighbor's house. The neighbor, his dear friend, well, not a dear friend, was a pig. And this pig may not have been the brightest pig around. This pig built his house entirely out of straw. Who builds a house entirely out of straw? Sorry? The youngest pig. Sure. Let's not get too attached to the pigs. So Alexander goes to the door and he knocks on the door and the door just falls in because it's a house made of straw, and he calls out and he says, Pig, are you here? I need a cup of sugar so I can finish the cake for my grandma. And there's no answer. And he calls out, Pig, are you here? I just need a cup of sugar. No answer. Alexander's like, okay, well, I guess I'll go home, or maybe I'll go find another neighbor. And he starts to turn, and he starts to sniffle. And he starts to huff, and the sneeze starts to... And, the straw house falls down. Sadly, in the process of the straw house falling down, the pig gets crushed and dies. I know. Well, the logistics are something we're going to work out. Maybe there was a lamp inside. I don't know. In any case, this is how Alexander tells the story. At that point, there's basically a cheeseburger lying in the middle of the floor. You can't just leave a cheeseburger there. You got to eat it. So Alexander does what he does and eats the pig. Because, you know, he's hungry. He starts to feel a little bit better. The cold's starting to go away a little bit. He's feeling better. He's like, okay, well, let's go on to the next house. And he goes to the next house, and it's the pig's brother. First pig's brother. This is the second pig. And the second pig, a little bit brighter, built his house out of sticks. Alexander knocks on the door, says, Pig, I need a cup of sugar. The pig says, go away, I'm shaving the hairs on my chin. Alexander says, well, that's a pretty mean pig. And so he turns around, but as he's turning around, he puts his hand on the edge of the door and he feels that huffing coming along, that snuffling again. And the whole house falls down again. And that's right. That's right. The second pig also dies. Now, Alexander's learned you don't just waste food. Alexander's learned that you don't just waste food. And so Alexander has his second helping of the day. And, you know, Alexander's starting to feel a fair bit better. So he moves on to the third house because he still doesn't have the cup of sugar. Still doesn't have the cup of sugar for grandma's cake. Moves on to the third house, and there the pig has built a house built out of bricks. Alexander comes up and knocks on the door and says, Pig, can I borrow a cup of sugar? I want to make my grandma's cake. And the pig says something mean and nasty to Alexander. Yep, it was sad. Alexander.
He's not going to repeat it because it is inappropriate for your age.
It's inappropriate for many of our ages, yeah. 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 So, Alexander, having been told off by the pig, is frustrated, is disappointed. Alexander starts to, unfortunately, get the snuffle again. And he gets the huffles and he snuffles and he... Achoo! House doesn't fall down. This house is built out of brick. Everything's fine. Except the pig then sticks his nose out the door and says, and your grandma could go sit on a pin. Now, I don't know what that means, but Alexander was very upset about it. And so, at that point, Alexander said some mean things, and Alexander got all in a huff and a snuff. And well, then at that point, they called the police, and the police came, and, you know, Alexander was causing a bit of a ruckus. And well, yeah. Then the media came. And the reporters came, and the reporters found out about the other two pigs, and, you know, a story about a wolf who needs a cup of sugar, well, that's just not a good story. So the story that gets reported in the media is about a huffing and stuffing, and I'll blow your house down. None of that's true. None of that part's true. It was just a wolf on a day when he needed a cup of sugar and had a bad cold. The stories we understand when they come from another perspective. I invite you now into a moment of reflection, prayer, meditation. Out walking one morning, I saw a medium-sized turtle begin the dangerous journey across the road from one side of Monponset Pond to the other. The traffic's pretty heavy at 6 a.m., and as the turtle left the safety of the roadside grasses, I looked right and could see a line of cars coming, led by a Harley Davidson, ridden by a leather-clad figure in a tinted plexiglass helmet. The turtle was almost at the halfway point, destined for extinction beneath those burning wheels. I moved a few paces into the road and simply pointed to the turtle. The motorcyclist slowed, bringing his gleaming bike to a stop. He put out his arm to indicate to the cars behind him that they should not overtake. He allowed the turtle to cross in safety. Then he and I signaled a greeting to each other and went on our ways. The turtle, the motorcyclist, and I were on different journeys that day. And mine was a journey of discovery. I discovered that compassion sometimes wears a motorcycle helmet. I found the place inside me that fears bikers, and I made a few corrections. I don't know what kind of day the turtle had, or the person on the motorcycle, but my day was better for having encountered them both. The words of Elizabeth Tarbox.
Change. I found that there's two things in life that I, as a Unitarian Universalist, don't like. They are the way things are and change. Today we've changed something here at our church. No paper order of service. Is this a change that you can accept? Keep in mind, it's just for today's service. This is not a permanent change. We all have lived through changes in our lives. Some of the changes in my life over the past couple of years include a new career and grandchildren. I now understand what my father always said about grandchildren, that if I'd have known how much fun they were, I'd have had them first. There was a time in my life when I was very resistant to change. As a young teen, my parents packed us up and moved from Ontario to Victoria. That was not something I was too pleased with. I left behind all my friends and came to this new place and had to make all new friends. Now keep in mind, these weren't the Facebook kind of friends. Of course, you can see looking at my gray hair, Facebook wasn't around then. But I still felt that they were my lifelong friends. I was given no choice but to accept the change of location, move on, and make new friends. I've asked myself, what makes it so hard for me to accept change? Don't get me wrong, there are many times when I can readily accept change, but there are those times when I struggle with it. Am I in denial about something? I once heard someone say, denial is not the river in Egypt, but I can still drown in it. Is it that I have fears of stepping outside of my comfort zone? An example of that is becoming a worship associate. That was a big change for me. Having to stand up here and speak to everyone, I was stepping outside of my comfort zone. I remember those fears vividly. I have many more thoughts about why I can sometimes struggle to accept change, so I won't bore you with them all. In the meantime, I will continue to reflect on change and what I can do to grow and accept change in my life and in the world that surrounds me. Are you accepting of change?
Last spring, I sat at the end of one of the tables during this auction. I was sitting kind of right back there, chatting with Gloria Hopewell. I wasn't paying attention to the other end of the table. Margot and Helen were furiously bidding for the opportunity to tell me what to do. I imagine there are some among you who wouldn't mind the opportunity from time to time to tell them what to do. My offering in the auction was this sermon. After she won, I asked Helen, have you already given some thought to what you want the service to be about? She says, oh yes, of course. I want you to talk to us about why we're failing our youth and young people so miserably. Oh. Really? Not really what I was expecting when I offered the sermon in the auction. Reverend Shauna had preached just a couple of months earlier on her auction sermon from the previous year. I think the subject was music. Why is it so great? Gotta say, I felt like I was getting the fuzzy end of the lollipop in this exchange. I could imagine the sign down by the road, we are miserable failures. Join us. Sunday, 10:30. It felt to me like an inevitable setup for a scolding. A sermon talking about all the things that we're doing wrong. And honestly, it makes me a little miserable to think about it. Because I don't find that I have easy answers, and I'm not sure I have hard answers to offer either. And the disappointment and the heartbreak that I've known in my own youth who have bridged to adulthood and found themselves set adrift by their faith is a raw wound in me. But for all of this, Helen's question, though she pulls no punches, was truly asked with love, with concern, and with care. And in the days, weeks, and months that followed, I heard the same request, the same question coming up in a lot of different ways and places. The study about the death of Sunday school, plans around the coming year when we didn't seem to have any youth to gather in a group. In the strategic planning fora and financial planning that asked what the future holds for Unitarian communities in general, and this one in particular. And I know that those questions that get my insides into knots, well, there's something there that needs to be untangled. So what do you think? Are we failing our young people? Looking around the room, it's hard not to simply say yes. This congregation, like most of our UU congregations, doesn't have many young adults participating, whether on a Sunday morning or any other time. Across our denomination, we lose more than 90% of our children and youth when they become adults. 90%. I don't know how many youth we've had here in the recent past, but it seems that few of them are here now. We used to say to ourselves, oh, they'll be back when they have kids. Unfortunately, that's not true. It hasn't been for more than a generation, if it ever really was true in the aggregate and not anecdotal. Emily Parker, who is a UU in the New England region, is studying UU youth in those emergent years from 18 to 24, and she's focused on the ones who are really involved to see if there's something in their particular experience that might shed some light on why they leave. Her post-bridging survey project asks the following three questions. Why do so many UU youth lose connection with UU communities as they move into young adulthood? Are we failing our youth? Are we instead preparing them for their own free and responsible search for truth and meaning? Parker's findings were fairly clear. When they bridge, engaged UU youth become drastically less engaged UU young adults. This drop-off in engagement is so dramatic in the first year, it is cliff-like. Survey respondents who dedicated more than 1 hour a week to UU activities dropped from 78% of youth to 31% of first-year young adults. As youth, 41% rate the importance of UU in their lives as 10 out of 10. And 44% are certain they will stay involved for the rest of their lives. 1 year later, those figures have dropped to 19 and 28%, respectively. In that year of transition from youth to young adulthood, more than 50% of the folks who said that their faith community and identity was amongst the most important things in their lives no longer thought that. If we are failing our young people, maybe it's in not seeing how we become irrelevant in their lives in those years. So I'm naming this a problem. One of the challenges of looking at the issue is that many in our congregations don't think it's a problem at all. I remember a conversation at my old congregation in Kingston, Ontario, where we were thinking about this issue too. Lest you think this is particular to us here, this is a question that happens everywhere, all the time. In a congregational meeting, someone said that they were completely unconcerned if our young people didn't stay involved in our congregations or come back to our churches. It didn't matter. From their perspective, our goal should be to educate our young people and then send them out into the world to make up their own minds. If they want to come back, hey, great. If not, they'll still be Unitarians out in the world. That's a good thing too, right? I wonder sometimes where that comes from, that belief that if we love our kids, we should set them free, untethered, disconnected, free. I wonder sometimes how we come to mark our youth leaving us as a success. I wonder sometimes if it comes out of the fact that most of us come to Unitarianism as adults, often on our own. I wonder sometimes if we think this because it's how we came in the doors ourselves, on our own quest for community, spirituality, philosophy that speak to us. Having found it, we imagine that others must find it in the same way. That search is often a lonely and frustrating one, and many arrive here asking where the heck we've been all their lives. I've been a Unitarian all my life, I just didn't know it, is a common refrain. Why do we seem to expect that everyone needs a quest like Odysseus in order to belong here? Our fourth principle, the free and responsible search for truth and meaning, is a sacred one for many Unitarians. Outside of the first and the last, it's also the one they tend to remember. But many of us are more attached to the freedom than to the responsibility. In some ways, it's written into the DNA of our congregations and the abundant individualism we sometimes find there. The biggest expansion in Unitarian Universalism happened in the 1950s during the Fellowship Movement. More than half the Unitarian congregations in Canada were founded between 1952 and 1958. And so much of that expansion was about seeking a freedom from rather than a freedom to. Freedom from a religion that didn't admit science's questions, freedom from a value system that oppressed and denied who we were, that separated us from one another, that said some were better than others. Freedom from a narrative that said that the only way to be moral was to follow these precepts or those without question. But that freedom from is not our context anymore. The values we embraced then are mainstream values now, even if the current political climate to the south suggests otherwise. It's past time that we turn our attention to the second piece of that statement, the responsibility. Because the root of responsibility is response, or responsive. Responsivity demands that we be in relationship, that we have something and someone to respond to, that we have someone to be accountable to. When we declare it a success to raise a UU youth and cast them out into the world in their emerging adult years, we seem to be saying that UUism is something learned or formed, a collection of moral precepts and values that people can carry forward on their own, freely, however they like, sometimes alone, however they like. But I don't think you can be a Unitarian without other Unitarians around you. It's not a thing we can be all on our own. We cannot be UUs without being a covenant. We cannot be UUs outside of our interdependence. And if young people don't have a place where they can continue their practice of interdependence to live into their love and covenant, they won't be UUs anymore. They'll still want those things. All the surveys tell us they will still want those things. My friends and neighbors, my sister-in-law, they all want those things. Sadly, they're not finding them with us. Sometimes when we talk about the experience of youth in our churches, we talk about the precipitous gap between youth group and the stark absence beyond. We hold a bridging service, which our youth sometimes describe as being involuntarily pushed off a cliff, because it feels like a bridge to nowhere, or at least to a profoundly unknown land. After all, there's a pretty stark difference between the experiences of our young people in our congregations who participate in youth groups and the wider congregations to which they belong. Youth groups are focused on interpersonal sharing and a very tight community. There's six pillars: building community, social action, worship, learning, leadership, and congregational involvement are all activities that they undertake together with the same small group, not diffused throughout the community or institution. When they worship, the norm is that they're all contributors to the experience, producers, not consumers, active, not passive. Their services are usually just as formulaic as our own, but with very different ingredients. Sunday morning and the sermon sandwich structure of our Protestant heritage are a long way from the experience of worship in youth groups. And many, if not most, youth find the adult way unsatisfying in contrast to what they've grown up with. Our congregations often offer little to young adults in those emerging years, those years when they are asking the most significant questions about what they're going to do with their lives. We've actually renamed those years, calling them the emergent years and not young adulthood. They ask significant questions of what they're going to do with their lives, how they're going to be in relationship, where they will find meaning and purpose. In this most significant time of personal formation, our youth tell us that they feel like they got a nice pat on the back, a well-wishing for the journey, and a firm display that there wasn't anything for them in our churches right now. But we'd be happy to have them come back later if they want to join the already existing adult thing. What might it mean to offer what they need? What would it require of us? More than anything else, it would require change. And as Larry said, there are two things we can't stand in UU churches: the way things are, and change. Resistance is a really good theme for talking about how our congregations and our movement relates to its young people, because that resistance flows both ways. If we're going to seriously consider the needs of our young people, of our bridging youth, we'll have to change. We'll have to change as individuals, we'll have to change as a congregation, we'll have to change as a denomination, and our youth will change too. And we will either resist that change or we will be part of it. I often find myself coming back to management consultant Peter Senge's axiom. He says, people don't resist change, they resist being changed. People don't resist change, they resist being changed. On both sides of that equation, that is sometimes what it feels like. It feels like our Sunday mornings would be changed by something else, by the presence of somebody else's need. The youth speak about their being forced to change, to grow up into a particular kind of adulthood, a particular kind of worship. And so both sides are resisting to change. For change to be successful, we must be and feel a part of it. Active agents in creating the new way, not passive objects being acted upon. We have to learn to listen to another story, to hear another perspective, maybe even sometimes listen to the wolf, like in our fractured fairy tale. From another person's perspective, the story changes. From another person's perspective, who we are changes. In my emerging adult years, I spent some time as a film major, and I was obsessed with Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon. It was the film equivalent of Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet, Clea, Mount Olive, Balthazar, and Justine, one of my favorite book series in high school. Both Rashomon and the Alexandria Quartet are simple stories. Very little actually happens. But they have so many parts. The story is simple because it's the same story told over and over and over from multiple perspectives. Each invites us into a scene to imagine how the story is different depending on where we're standing. Who the villain is, who the hero is, what the story is depends on who is experiencing it and who's telling it. In the end, the story is all called to mind for me the Hindu parable about the blind men encountering the elephant. This being a somewhat old parable, it uses language that isn't terribly respectful of people with vision impairments, and also presumes a lot of masculinity. Nonetheless, it's a parable and metaphor. In that story, a group of blind men heard that a strange animal called an elephant had been brought to the town, but none of them were aware of its shape and form. Out of curiosity, they said, "We must inspect it and know it by touch, of which we are capable." So they sought it out, and when they found it, they groped about it. In the case of the first person, whose hand landed on the trunk, said, "This being is like a thick snake." For another, whose hand reached its ear, it seemed like a kind of fan. For another, whose hand was upon its leg, the elephant is a pillar, is a tree trunk. The blind man who placed his hand upon its side said, "The elephant is a wall." And another who felt its tail described it as a rope. The last felt its tusk, stating that the elephant is that which is hard and smooth like a spear. In most versions of the story, the men all start fighting, accusing each other of being liars. In some versions, it gets very heated. But eventually, the story always turns to them starting to hear one another. They bring their hands to touch one another's hands and to feel the transitions between what they felt and what their neighbor did. They knew then that their truth was a partial truth. They were all partially correct and partially incorrect. While each of their experiences was true, none of them were true in totality. Our church communities can be like that too. Each of us holding on to different parts of the elephant and saying, "This is what this church is. This is what our faith means." Each of us has come from a place, has had an experience that brought us here. And most of us have a firm grasp of some bit of the elephant. And we can come to cling to that place with certainty, especially if we've had a hard and lonely road to get here. Standing in certainty makes change hard, if not impossible. There was a great interview I was listening to last summer between Ezra Klein of Vox Radio and Julia Galef. Julia hosts the Rationally Speaking podcast and is founder of the Center for Applied Rationality. Probably didn't know that existed. Center for Applied Rationality. Galef's work focuses on how we think and argue, as well as the cognitive biases and traps that keep us from hearing what we're really saying, hearing what others are really saying, and preferring answers that make us feel good to answers that are true. Her research and work is in helping people learn to change their minds. Note, I didn't say that her research is in learning to change other people's minds. It's in learning to change our own. And how do we do that? She talks about signaling, about motivated reasoning, about probabilistic debating,
It's about an hour and a half long, so we won't go into all of it. And she talks about the identities that help us find truth and the cognitive biases that get in our way. She talks about one of my favorites, cognitive dissonance, and the split-second processes that make us rationalize our choices even when they conflict with our values. She talks about the real work as being about extending that split second to a full second. Before you respond, before you reply, but to rationalize, before you try to make the story into something that fits you, how long can you hold the discomfort? Because the longer you can hold the discomfort, the more you're not reacting. The more you're not reacting out of an old story, an existing bias. In short, she explains why being in community and being in covenant can be so darn hard sometimes. We are literally wired in ways that make change hard. So it takes intention, commitment, and work to remain open. I remember doing a change leadership workshop many years ago at the Shambhala Institute, and the facilitator started off by telling us a really, really long story about trying to put a second story on his house in a gated community in the Florida Keys. Have to say, I really didn't care. But as the story went on, he talked about how his family had lived there a long time, and he had a mother-in-law who wanted to come and move in with them, and they needed more space. But the whole neighborhood was single-story bungalows, so there had to be a public hearing. And people came out in droves to oppose his variance and building plan. One after another, they talked about how his second story would change the nature of the community, would increase density, make it feel too crowded. It was a slippery slope, after all, because if he did it, wouldn't everybody? He'd lived there for more than 2 decades and realized that he didn't know any of the people who were protesting him. Turns out that his community was demonstrating a well-understood principle in sociology. Generally speaking, the people who have most recently arrived are the most fervent defenders of the way things are. After all, they just found what they were looking for. They don't want it to change. There's a really strong correlation between longevity and comfort with change. The longer you've been in a place, the more it has changed, the more you've grown comfortable with the fact that it changes. There is wisdom in it and a non-anxious ease, and it's part of why we honor our elders and why we need them so. Because in each of their stories is a story of how we have changed. This isn't meant as a challenge to those of you who recently joined the community. We're glad you're here. It's an acknowledgement that we've all been there at some point. We've all gone through this process, and for all of us, this community has changed and this community will continue to change. And if we are to be with one another, if we are to be with all of us, we need to find ways to be open to it. Because the community we think we know is the community we see and feel from our place of partial truth. And there are many, many truths. Feel free to count the number of people in your aisle. That's how many truths there are in your row. There are so many truths in this room, in the coming of age class, and beyond. And to serve our young people well, we need to stand in their place. Hear the story of this church from their perspective. Know that their story is not our own. They are not living the life that we left behind. We might think that we're offering a generous send-off, a satchel well-stuffed with the things they'll need for their quest, their voyage, that we're giving them what we wish we'd had on our own quest for truth, for meaning, for a spiritual community that holds us. But for many, it feels still like they're being pushed off a cliff. So let's push less. Let's instead build a bridge. Let's meet partway on that bridge and walk together. Let us make our congregations and our communities places where people of any and all ages find a place to continue to quest and to question, to stand and see the story from another place, from another person's eyes, again and again. May we be so blessed. Blessed be.
We have peace like a river. We have strength like a mountain. I've got joy like a fountain. In this room, together we gather each week to share that with one another, to share our strength, to share our peace, to share our joy, to share it all. May you be blessed to be sitting next to somebody who is sharing with you and with whom you are sharing as well. And if you're not, move. Come, sit, join us. We are making a new world together. Blessed be.